Hello everyone. My name's Cathy Nance. I'm chairing this session. To introduce you to Melinda, who's speaking. Melinda is Director of Policy and Industry Practice with ASFA. Melinda's had 22 years experience in the financial services industry, most of which has been in superannuation. Before joining ASFA last September, Melinda was 4 years with ALEA Actuarial Consulting, designing superannuation benefit projection tools, case studies, superannuation technical and educational support for a range of wealth management and financial planning clients. A main focus of this role was illustrations of the adequacy of members' superannuation. Prior to that, Melinda was 9 years with Bankers Trust in a variety of roles, culminating in Director of Superannuation and Retirement Products. So Melinda's session today is on managing liquidity risk for accumulation funds. Melinda's going to be talking for about 20 minutes, and then we'll just open it up to questions and discussions. There's a couple of particular topic areas that Melinda wants to put on the agenda for discussion. So at that time, it'd be great to get your participation. There's a microphone in the middle. There'll be a roving mic. And if you could introduce your name and who you are with at the time, that would be great. So, Melinda, over to you.
Thanks, Cathy, and good morning. Okay, so I've got the very interesting topic today of managing liquidity risk in a volatile world. So the first part of the presentation is a little bit of scene setting. It's I'm going to be describing some of the factors that influence liquidity. And then we'll have a quick look at the legislative and APRA requirements, but then I really want to have some discussion at the end. I'm going to talk through quite a detailed liquidity risk management framework, and then we're going to have a couple of discussion points. So what is liquidity risk for a super fund? Well, pretty obviously, it's the risk that the fund cannot meet. It's benefit and pension payments, rollover requests or requests to switch, or other third-party payments at all, or without incurring significant costs, so being a forced seller, for example. I'm going to look, first of all, at a number of factors that affect liquidity of a super fund, and there's some fund-specific ones. And also we'll look at some external factors as well. So if we start with the fund-specific ones, first of all I want to look at cash flow and the different implications of different types of super funds and how cash flow affects what they do. You can see down the left there I've got inflows and outflows that resulting in net flows, and we'll also have a quick look at the impact that has on the investments. I just find it really hard to see here. This light's not... I'll continue on. Excuse me if I'm squinting. I don't have any light up here. Okay. So first of all, if we have a look at different types of accumulation super funds and the cash flow situation they're in, industry funds, first of all, contain mostly accumulation stage super and a little bit of retirement product in there as well, or retirement payments. So these funds have strong cash inflows. They have most of the money coming in is mandated super guarantee money, usually directed through an award. There's also a fair bit now of discretionary money going into those as well, because those funds are increasingly public offer. They have a relatively small volume of outflows, voluntary rollovers to other funds and some pension payments. So as a result, that type of fund is in a strong net inflow situation in pretty much all markets, and that means that those funds are able to hold a significant proportion of unlisted or illiquid assets. Next, we'll look at the corporate sector, which is pretty similar in terms of its inflows and outflows. They tend to have a little bit more pension money in there, so the outflows may be a little bit higher. But pretty much they are also generally in a net inflow situation and similarly can have the ability then to hold unlisted assets. And you could probably, I haven't separately identified public sector funds, but you could put them in the same, I think they'd be fairly similar there to the corporate funds. Then we've got retail funds, and they have quite a number of different styles of fund within them, so I might just go through some of the main categories. Firstly, a true retail super fund or personal super fund, they're sometimes called. Whilst they can get some SG money from smaller employers, it's mainly discretionary money going in, discretionary contributions and rollovers. And going out, mainly rollovers to other funds. For example, if someone just retires or moves to another product offerer. So normally those funds are in net inflow, but because all the money going in is discretionary, they can change very quickly to a net outflow situation. And that means these funds need to have significant liquidity. Oops, I've gone a bit far there. They need to have significant liquidity so they are less likely. In fact, all of these retail funds we'll see, they're less likely to hold unlisted assets, generally hold only listed. Now, wrap platforms, it's pretty similar here. They can be retirement-only products, so they can have more retirement money, so you'll see pension payments coming out of those as well. But it's a similar situation there, can swing very quickly from inflow to outflow. There's also corporate super within retail funds, and it has a pretty similar pattern to the corporate funds, standalone funds we saw over there. The difference with the corporate super retail funds is a whole employer can leave that fund and take all their employees to another fund. So you can, whilst they're generally an inflow, you can get big and fairly unpredictable outflows from that type of fund. And last of all, there are dedicated products that are only service retirees. So obviously rollovers go in, pension payments come out, and it's the balance between those two that determines whether they're in inflow or outflow. So again, they can swing quite quickly between net inflow and net outflow, depending on the balance of those things. So all the funds on the right-hand side of that diagram are vulnerable to quickly switching to outflow situations. We started to mention some of the investments there a moment ago, and I just want to build on that now as a second fund-specific factor. So there's been a well-documented increase, we all know this, in unlisted assets being held in the super industry. I've listed some of them there. Retail fund managers, as we saw, have less ability to do this. And in fact, the retail funds tried it specifically on the investment side. Back in the 80s, they had a lot of unlisted property trusts. And then in the early 90s, when there was a big slump in the property market, some of you may remember this, a lot of those funds got frozen. So retail have been burned by this before, and they've tended to then steer away from unlisted assets. And that sort of philosophy is carried through to their super products as well. But holding listed investments hasn't really been much of a help either over recent months, because even listed assets are currently proving to be quite illiquid in some cases. And also bonds, which would typically offer liquidity, again, have been illiquid as well. So there's really been nowhere to hide. To compound this issue, some funds have had quite large and somewhat unexpected payouts on currency hedging contracts where they were holding overseas investments. And what happened was the value of those investments fell, and so they've actually had to make almost like margin call payments on those hedging contracts. So that's been an unusual circumstance as well. Now, it's important to recognise that the strategic asset allocations kind of control or constrain how a super fund can react to these types of quite extreme market situations and what trustees can do. So there have been a lot of funds recently reworking their strategic asset allocations to give themselves broader ranges and maybe a higher allocation to cash and a little more flexibility on how to react. Okay, the third fund-specific issue is fund design. And this is all pretty obvious stuff. I'll just go through it quite quickly. Obviously, the number of investment options has an impact. You know, there's funds that have 6 investment options, there's wrap products that have 200 investment options, and there's everything in between. Obviously, the more options, the less money you have in each option, potentially, and the more members might switch around between them. The ease of switching also impacts how much switching you're going to get. I believe we'll see, as time goes by, less and less money in the main or default balanced investment option, where most of the money tends to sit at the moment. As we add more investment options to products, as members have advice and easy access to that, we see patterns where members start to move their money around a little more. The next generation of retirees also, just onto another point, we can expect them, they've just been burned by this market downturn. We could expect them to invest quite conservatively as they go into retirement. And so that, whilst retirees have been happy to have balanced funds over the last few years because they've done very well, we're probably going to see less growth options in retirees' portfolios. So again, that could constrain liquidity. But there is a little bit of good news on this side of things, because product innovation in that pension space may help here. We're starting to see products where someone can keep a balanced fund but insure themselves against the risk of longevity or the risk of markets going down. So as that sort of product innovation happens, there may be more money staying in those more aggressive options in retirement. The fourth fund-specific factor is demography. I don't have to really go through this in detail to a room full of actuaries, but obviously all these types of factors will come into play in liquidity, and what they boil down to is how likely are the members to have their balance paid out, to retire and start a pension, or to retire and take cash out entirely. And as you know, now there's no tax on people cashing their money out of super, so it's easier for them to do that. And also, the bank guarantee has caused some retirees to actually take their money out of super and put it in a guaranteed bank account. So we've seen that unexpected impact too. Or lastly, how likely are they to take higher than usual pension payments and vary their payments? And there's a significant ability to do that now. The last fund-specific factor is member behaviour. And again, it's fairly obvious stuff, but depending on the financial literacy of the members of the fund and how much access they have to financial advice, that will drive their behaviour. And it all boils down to how likely members are to switch investments, to choose another fund, so to leave your fund altogether, or better still, to take your fund with them from job to job so they actually have it for life. So I think as time goes by, we'll see more and more super fund members switching their options and using portability. So whilst some of these things have been thrown into focus by the current crisis, I think the world is changing and these sorts of issues are here to stay, and I think that we really probably have to change the way we think about where the money is going to be in future years. It's not all going to be sitting in a balanced default option. Okay, I want to touch on a couple of external factors that are happening, obviously the global financial crisis, but also there are some other things happening right now, external factors that are having an influence on liquidity. In terms of the financial crisis, we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about this, we've heard a lot about it this morning, but really the increased volatility and declining returns, the illiquidity of pretty much everything at the moment except cash and equities, has really created quite an interesting situation for trustees trying to manage their funds' liquidity. We've seen some freezes on redemptions by some fund managers, and there are quite a number of individual investment options frozen at the moment. What changes, though, is it going to drive in people's behaviour? Firstly, we've seen an increase in switches to cash, generally out of balance. Hard data is a bit difficult to come by, but ASFA did some surveys late last year in the last quarter, and at that stage the average was only around 2% of balances had moved to cash at that stage. It was higher in some areas of the industry, but that was generally where it sat. We could probably expect that to be a little higher now, but it has been lower than everybody thought it was going to be. What has been a major impact, though, is stopped or lower discretionary contributions, and we do have some good data, APRA data on that. It's dropped 50%. So remember back to my diagram of all those retail funds over this side that have dependent on discretionary inflows. Those inflows have dried up. So as a result of the financial crisis, super funds really have experienced a perfect storm of events. Falling values of listed equities and property have pushed up the proportion of unlisted investments for those funds that hold them. The lack of liquidity in bond markets and also some parts of the equity markets, and more members switching out of balanced options and into cash. So what's the impact been of that storm? I think we can say that so far most funds have held up pretty well, which is encouraging given the severity of what's been going on. But I wanted to show you, I've depicted a balanced fund here, and I've depicted it as a tank of water. And I've got some of the different asset types represented down there, and I've ranked them from more liquid to less liquid. So while there's still cash available to meet payments, so the water level's up in the cash section, all is well. In normal markets, you could probably include bonds as in there as well, because they're usually quite liquid at the moment. They're not really an option. They're completely illiquid, unless they're government bonds, but there's not many of those out there. However, if the balance between cash flows in and out is disturbed, what happens when the level of that tank starts to fall, when the liquidity tide goes out? Now, there's a point I want to make here in a moment, but one thing that could happen is if a lot of funds do run out of cash and they start to get down to the next most liquid thing at the moment is their equities. Just as an aside, what impact could that have on markets if a lot of super funds suddenly start to dump their listed equities to create some liquidity? So that's a scary little side thought for you. But the main point I want to make here is when everything's illiquid and as that liquidity waterline falls, when does a trustee make the call that they've run out of liquidity? When do they suspend redemptions? It's a very difficult issue. It's important to recognise I'm not talking here about funds losing money. I'm not talking about funds failing. I'm talking about the tension between members who are staying in the fund and members who want to leave the fund, either redeem altogether or switch between different investment options. And it's the equity issues between the leaving and the staying members that trustees are having to balance. They've got to act in the best interest of both sets of members, obviously. And in the current market, that tension between leaving and staying members has increased. And there are a number of funds that have been having conversations with APRA about this and seeking their guidance. And feedback we're getting is that regulatory process is working pretty well. A couple of other factors that are going on at the moment that are impacting liquidity. Firstly, I've already predicted that over coming years we'll see increased portability. E-enablement of the industry, which is progressing apace, will just drive that. Once it's easier for people to roll over from one fund to another, that's still a fairly manual, lumpy, lots of paperwork process. We'll start to see more money moving around the system. Secondly, it'll be interesting to see the fallout from award modernisation. As I'm sure you're aware, we've got thousands of awards in Australia at the moment. They're all in the process this year of being rolled up into a smaller number of national awards. There'll be 40 or 50, I think, national awards. And those awards name superfunds, and the superfunds being named tend to be large national industry superfunds because they're large national awards now. So for smaller or state-based funds who aren't named in the new awards but were named in the old awards, there won't be any immediate impact because there's grandfathering provisions to say, look, if an employer's been contributing to XYZ industry fund and then named in the old award, they can keep contributing to that fund. So it's not like the money's all going to move immediately. But over time, as new employers are created, all those new employers will be contributing to these new big nationally named funds. So for the funds not named, gradually that liquidity tap of guaranteed contributions coming in will start to be turned off. The other interesting and very, in retrospect, poorly timed thing is that the government is requiring super funds to pay the balances of all temporary residents, people who've been working in Australia but have since left. They all have to be paid to the ATO by the 15th of June this year. We don't know how big that payment's going to be yet because funds are just starting to get the requests now, or the detailed list, but I've heard estimates of $800 million. So where's the industry going to get the cash to pay $800 million on the 15th of June? Okay, so that was some scene setting. Let's just have a quick look at the legislative requirements. There's two areas where the SIS legislation refers to liquidity. Obviously, firstly, when forming the investment strategy, the liquidity must be taken into account. And secondly, liquidity risk is an element that needs to be covered in a fund's risk management plan. Now, APRA have outlined their expectations for trustees in respect of liquidity in a questionnaire and then a letter in 2008. And there was also a paper in 2008 that went through these issues. So I've summarised the requirements here. But you'll see that they involve understanding the liquidity situation, monitoring it, managing it, modelling and forecasting what's going to happen in the future. And it's important to note the liquidity needs to be managed within each investment option the fund offers, and APRA expects a third party sign off as well. So how might a fund actually do this? How might they manage it? Well, this is an example of a type of liquidity risk management process a fund could implement, and KPMG Super have kindly allowed me to use their material here. So this is how it could work. Firstly, you perform a demographic analysis. So you analyse your membership over the last 10 years and you forecast the most likely changes over the next 5 to 10 years, taking into account population trends, employment statistics, etc. Secondly, a liquidity projection's performed. So you analyse your cash inflows and outflows monthly, month by month over the last 2 years. You get a pattern from that and you use that to predict what's going to happen over the next year, month by month. And you'd obviously allow for things like what's happening in markets and other factors as well. Then stress testing is performed. From the base case of that 12-month forecast, scenarios are developed and you undertake stress testing based on those scenarios. And that's done at investment option level. And it includes an assessment of the liquidity of the fund's investments. Scenarios tested could include things like large-scale retrenchments or retirements, large numbers of members exercising portability, reduced income from assets, etc. So then you can actually work out a detailed action plan detailing the steps that would be required to overcome a liquidity crisis, and that would include the order in which you're going to sell down your assets. Then lastly, any adjustments or improvements to those processes can then be considered in the light of all of that information. So that it then feed into your risk management process. Your risk management statement and risk management plan should be reviewed, and you'd incorporate any issues into your fund's investment strategy. If you're going to use derivatives as one of your ways of managing your liquidity, you'd also need to look at your derivative risk statement. So that's a fairly comprehensive process. Now, even if a fund was doing all of that, was doing that detailed liquidity management process, which a lot of funds are, it's unlikely that any scenario test anyone could have thought of would have been run as deeply as the perfect storm we've just experienced. And, you know, a normal scenario testing, my understanding is, in compliance models, it goes out to two or maybe three standard deviations, and we're hearing this morning that we've had a 5 standard deviation event. So it's a 1 in 100 year occurrence. Portfolios weren't constructed to allow for that. And neither should they have been. If you construct your portfolio on the basis that you might have a 5 standard deviation event, you could argue that you weren't really serving your members very well. But there are things that we could do differently in the future. First of all, funds will now run deeper scenario testing. They'll actually run what's happened over the last 18 months as their worst case scenario. So that'll be, whilst they may not change the way they're investing necessarily their portfolios, they might actually have different contingency plans in place for what happens if. But I also want to raise a couple of probably quite contentious discussion points now. And at the moment, funds have limited ability to build up cash outside their strategic asset allocation ranges. And even if they change their SAAs and advise all the members and do all the right things, there's a limit to how much cash they can really hold. I'd like to throw open then for discussion, should funds hold capital? Should they be required to hold capital, accumulation-style super funds? Now, some funds have access to capital. A corporate fund, you could argue, that the company would be able to throw some capital in there. A retail fund, you could argue that the shareholders can provide capital. But should there be a requirement for this to be the case? A pool of capital could be used not just to provide liquidity, but also for other purposes. And I've listed a few there. In a situation like this, the fund's expenses go up. There's all this extra communication. You know, those sorts of costs need to be thought about as well. But holding capital is very expensive. Okay, it's going to impact on returns. And so it's a real balancing act here. Is there a smarter way it can be done? Is there a way that insurance can provide capital for this sort of situation? I mean, I don't know. I'm just throwing this up for contemplation. Another issue perhaps we can have a think about. Are there new statutory roles for actuaries that should be required on the accumulation fund side as a result of this? I mean, actuaries are very involved on the defined benefit super side, and there's lots of stuff we have to sign off there, but there's pretty minimal involvement on this side of the fence. So all these liquidity management plans that funds have in place, should an actuary be signing those off? What about how we value unlisted assets? And this is this debate's been going on in the industry for years. How do you value these things? And some people would argue it's more of an art than a science, but from what I've seen, and I'm not an expert on asset valuation by any means, but there doesn't appear to be a common methodology in how these are done. Different valuers have different ways of doing things. But it is, both of these things, the liquidity risk management plan and valuing unlisted assets, are valuing uncertain future cash flows. And who's the best at doing that? I think actuaries are. At the moment, the only professional that signs off those unlisted asset valuations is the auditor. So is there room for an increased role here? So just to wrap up, and then we can have a bit of a discussion, but I think we've experienced a perfect storm in terms of liquidity over the last few months. And I think we can say that at the moment, we've come through it so far pretty well. It's certainly highlighted the importance of that formal liquidity risk management program, but it's also shown us the strength of the regulatory framework that we're operating under, that the industry's actually held up well. I think I'd like to echo some comments that were made earlier about hedge fund managers. I think super funds will come out of this stronger and better equipped for the future, a better understanding of the risks we face, and probably more formalised procedures around managing liquidity, which will be very necessary as we move into quite a different world of member choice and member engagement in their super.
Thanks, Melinda.
Thank you.
Now, we have about 10-15 minutes for questions, so if I can encourage you to sort of keep your questions relatively brief. Whilst you're getting organised with people standing up, I have got a spare microphone here too, if people would like to grab it. But just whilst people are getting organised, Melinda, if I can ask you one question, and that is, have you seen any evidence of funds forcibly trying to slow down rollovers and liquidity? Like, I was reading something about someone wrote in and they wanted to move and it took weeks to get a form and then they got sent back to them because they'd missed filling out one minor box or something like that. Are you seeing any sort of evidence of that as a practice?
Well, I think the process of rolling out from a fund is incredibly tedious and lengthy in a lot of funds' cases anyway, and I know because I've just changed employers and had to do some consolidation and it's a pain in the neck. I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence of it, but it might be a strategy some funds would be contemplating, I guess, just slow down the paperwork flow. But no, I haven't got any personal knowledge on that.
Okay, questions? All right.
No, thanks. If I can start things off, Mike Barker, I'd like to start at the end of your slide there, valuing of unlisted assets. I think the superannuation industry has been seriously deficient on this point over the last few years. I think there's been largely a disinterest in trying to put an appropriate value on a whole lot of the unlisted assets. I'm speaking as a director of an unlisted property trust, which has been attempting to produce realistic values on a quarterly basis. And I find that, first of all, most of my competitors are not doing the same. Therefore, we're not being compared like to like, and our clients are accepting totally unrealistic valuations from some of the other unlisted property trusts. And I find that the actual clients seem to be quite happy to hold private equity at cost until the returns start to come through. There doesn't seem to be any idea that private equity is priced on the internal rate of return, and the internal rate of return should be brought out as immediately and not wait for 3 or 4 years until you start realising some of the investments. It just seems to be completely amateurish on the part of the super funds.
Just remember to introduce yourselves too.
Yeah, Mark Berry. I might just stay seated, sorry. One thing that really whether you should have unlisted assets in some of these vehicles, I think something to maybe debate as well. But I think if the, just to go another step back, if the member or the consumer actually owns the investments, then in a way you don't have the liquidity issue. So if you've got like an IMA type structure running inside the fund where the member's connected directly with the investments, then really the member's taking the liquidity risk. And I do understand that some of the industry funds like ARF, they can have up to half their balance invested in the top 100 stocks where they can actually pick, you know, they can have BHP or whatever it is. So I think you may see the evolution of those sort of products where the member is directly taking the liquidity risk rather than the fund sort of taking it. And I think that would probably even be more consumer-friendly, because when you've got things where you've sort of got capital and smoothing and stuff like that going on, then you get all sorts of equity issues coming out, like you sort of highlight in your paper, and I think they would worry me a bit. I think if I was a member, I'd rather own the investments directly.
That's interesting then, because the regulator says that the trustee has to, you know, monitor. I think this is another area of tension that, you know, in the old world where everyone was in a balanced fund, it was easy for the trustee to set the investment strategy and, you know, the members really just accepted it. In this new world we're moving into, we've already got the situation in some of these types of products, and wraps are another example, that the member has ultimate choice. And how much should the trustee really be saying, hang on, you shouldn't have all your money in one equity? So, you know, I think if we are moving into that sort of world, the regulatory framework, I don't know, either it needs to change or trustees need to change and restrict the way people are picking their investments within those.
Glenn Langton, I just want to pick up the question of how the liquidity premium in the unlisted securities, a lot of the additional yield that you get out of unlisted securities actually is the premium that's built into those particular securities because of their illiquidity. The problem that I see is that what most, well, virtually superannuation funds do is that they take that liquidity premium into their return that's actually allocated to members on a year-to-year basis. So they basically treat the liquidity premium as profit to be distributed on a monthly basis or on a daily basis. If the liquidity premium really isn't profit, if it really is a premium that you're paying for a real risk, then it shouldn't be allocated as profit to members. It should be kept there to actually finance the cost of having to actually realise these particular securities at somewhere down the track at a cost. I haven't seen anything that's sort of looking at how you properly account for the illiquidity premium and whether it is really a profit in part of the fund and in some of the funds that do have a liquidity problem.
I haven't either, but yeah, it's an interesting point. Even if you did that and you set aside, you know, a little liquidity pool or something, some of these assets you can't really even ever... It's very difficult to ever sell them. You know what I mean? It's if you've got infrastructure investments or something like that, it's you have to find someone else, I guess, to take over your part of it. So yeah. It's high, yeah.
Jonathan Sheed here. I don't know whether I'm speaking about the elephant in the room, but I think if you go back to Bob Yeager's comments about different kinds of markets, the one that worries me is the dysfunctional one. And I think, you know, my sense is that a run on an industry fund or a run on a product or a run on an investment option is actually, it's not so much the normal modelling that's the issue in terms of liquidity. It's what happens if you have a run. And I think if you have a run, 200 basis points of liquidity premium, you know, will last you for the first half a day. You know, capital will last you maybe for the first 3 days, and after that you're in strife. And I think, you know, that freezing redemptions and so on, we then start to talk about those kind of options. The thing I'm curious about is to what extent does the increased use of financial advice, will that be more likely to exacerbate a run, or is it more likely to actually stop a run developing? And I'm thinking in particular what happened in the press with Storm in October and November and so on, and I'd certainly be interested in in people's thoughts about whether the involvement of financial advice will mean people will feel they've got to get out there really quick to get their clients out as quickly as they can, or whether, you know, financial advice will mean people take a, quote, longer-term, end quote, view.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it probably depends on the advice to some extent, but I think figures that IFSA have put out through this crisis have shown that people who have financial advice have been less likely to panic and move their money around as a result of this and have been more likely to stick to their longer-term strategy. So advice could actually be a positive. But we have also seen, I mean, there was an example in the press of one financial advisory firm advising their clients to get out of a certain super fund, so which wasn't one they advised on. So, you know, there's... I think there could be effects both ways. I think what we will see, though, is over time all funds are starting to offer advice now. Advice models are being rolled out right across the industry, even areas where members typically haven't had access to it. So we will see people being more active with their decisions, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be changing around their money around regularly. It just means they're more likely to pick an option that's not the default. That's my view anyway. But we may see them shopping for super funds, I think, at some... This is probably a way down the track, but look at the way we shop for mortgages now. It's easy to change mortgages. When it becomes easy to change super funds and you don't have all that paperwork, will people shop around for the best deal, the lowest fees, the best returns, the best services? So that could really change the face of the industry.
I've just got a question. Has anyone discovered problems with a deferred tax asset? If most of your assets are now worth less than what you purchased them for, you must have a deferred tax asset. Are people holding them as the full amount of the tax, or are they allowing for a time discount effect? Does it cause a problem with your cash flow? I mean, you're actually a person who rolls over is taking cash for this deferred tax asset.
I know a lot of funds are looking at that at their DTAs at the moment. I mean, it's also called FITB, or it used to be called FITB for those who remember the 2001 issues. A lot of funds are very closely monitoring their DTAs at the moment. ASFA's in the process of writing a guidance paper on this, which we hope to have out in the next couple of months. So, yeah, it's certainly an issue that's very much front of mind, I think, for a lot of super funds that we've been talking to.
And I think I can also say from an auditing point of view, audit companies are all over that, and they'll tend to cap it and not only allow you to bring in a certain percentage, so they don't allow you unlimited deferred tax asset.
Just a quick question, Rob Daly. I guess the heart of the issue for me is the conflict with the super fund between wanting to report a good return, which gets new contributions in, and treating exiting members fairly by, you know, quoting an appropriately, perhaps heavily discounted price. Could you maybe comment on how that issue is being addressed?
Well, I might throw it open to the floor. I mean, the more focus we have on funds competing with each other, I mean, we're about to get the so-called league tables where funds are not actually their returns, but their return on assets, which is kind of a mixture of their returns and their cost structure, is going to be reported by APRA on a fairly regular basis. So that'll sort of really start to mean funds are competing even more for that inflow dollar. So, yeah, I mean, does anyone have any views on that? But you're right, it's definitely a tension and a conflict.
I think the bells are telling us that it's pretty well time to go. So, sorry about that. Thanks, Melinda.
Thank
you. It's a really hot topic at the moment. So,